Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Bill Steigerwald. He's a longtime newspaper man, author of several books, most recently, an incredible story called 30 Days of Black Man, the forgotten story that exposed the Jim Crow South. Bill, thanks for talking to us.
Hi, how are you doing?
So you worked in Pittsburgh newspapers for a long time, and this new story is about a guy named Ray Spriggle, who was at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, a white reporter, editor, journalist. He was, at that point in the 1940s, he was most famous for exposing Hugo Black's membership in the Ku Klux Klan when he was elevated or nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States. What did Ray Spriggle do that moved you to write a book about his 30 days as a black man?
Well, what he did, and he did it throughout his whole career. It was an amazing career in Pittsburgh entirely. And I've always said that if he had worked at the New York Times and done everything he did, by 1950, Spencer Tracy would have played him in a movie. Spriggle was what they called an old-time, you know, newspaper man. And he was a tremendous writer. He had literary fiction skills. He was a pulp fiction writer in his youth. He became a journalist at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He was an editor for a while, and then he became their star reporter. He was their front page reporter. He did 50 stories a year. He did 21-part series on crime in Pittsburgh, 6-part series on black market meat during World War II, sales of black market meat. He was the greatest journalist in Pittsburgh in the 20th century. I don't think there's any question about that. Even if he hadn't won the Pulitzer for exposing Hugo Black's KKK ties, he did so much. And I worked at the Post-Gazette in 1995, and we were doing World War II 50th anniversary pieces, and I came across Spriggle's 1944 series on black market meat sales in Pittsburgh, and he took his false teeth out, got some old clothes, rented an old truck, and went out into the marketplace of Pittsburgh and bought a ton of meat illegally. And
because everything was rationed at that point, right?
Yeah,
in the U.S.
And he didn't use points and everything else. And then he wrote a 6-part series about it on the front page. And the local Office of Price Administration called him in after his first article wrote and said, "Hey, tell us what you know." And he said, "Don't worry, you'll read about it in the paper." And eventually, the OPA brought the federal guys here to Pittsburgh and held hearings. Anyway, he did that, and I said, "Wow, what an!" And the stories were written like so passionately. There wasn't any of this. Authorities say this. Spriggle was, as I say, a great fiction writer, a great reporter, and he wrote with enormous authority about anything he wrote about. If he was writing about black market meat sales, if he was writing about state mental hospitals, he did like 3 or 4 major pieces on state mental hospitals in Pennsylvania.
Well, let's get to the black market meat, and Jesus, I just stepped in it, didn't I? But about, you know, so in that was in 1944. He wrote about black markets in meat during wartime, but then in 1947, and I guess the book came out in 1948. He actually posed as a black man in the Jim Crow South, right?
Right.
Talk a little bit about, you know, what was the contours of his trip, and why did he do it? And you know, and then we'll talk more about the specifics of your book, of your account, 30 Days of Black Man, the Forgotten Story That Exposed the Jim Crow South, which is, you know, a terrifyingly urgent read, I think, for all Americans, you know, to be honest. Like, I can't say enough about the book and what it recovers. But talk about Spriggle. So, like, he decided to tour the South as a black man. How did that happen?
He was always looking for a great newspaper story, and he found them easily. And he came up with the idea, and it's not exactly clear where the idea came from, but he came up with the idea based on reports that he had heard of black soldiers coming back from World War II and and going back to Georgia and wanting to go to vote and having the crap kicked out of him or killed in a couple cases for merely doing that or expressing the desire to vote. And he came upon the idea of disguising himself as a black man and going into the Jim Crow South for a month so that he could see for himself the conditions under which 10 million black people lived under Jim Crow this was 1947 when he came up with the idea. He left in the spring of 48. He tried to dye his skin a couple times with chemicals and walnut juice, mahogany bark, and it didn't work, or his skin fell off. And I guess he could have killed himself if he had really doused himself with a couple.
But you also point out, you know, he eventually got a really bad sunburn and cut his hair short, et cetera, and he could pass. And, you know, this is one of the things, I mean, we hear in contemporary America, I guess, you know, we're more likely to hear stories, and you talk about this a bit in the book, of people passing as black, you know, for various reasons. Whereas back then, obviously, blacks tried to pass as white or as Italian sometimes, or Cubans. And it was actually relatively easy in the South because there was an extremely broad gradient of kind of skin color. And in a way, it exposes the total fiction of the Jim Crow South, where you could effectively be white but pass as black because it was, you know, it wasn't about anything real on a certain level.
Exactly. And he was told after he was experimenting for a while, when he finally connected with the NAACP and Walter White, and they found a guide, and he was talking to people in Atlanta about what he should do to color his skin. And the one guy, who was an executive at an insurance company, said, "Hey, just go down and get a really heavy tan." He said, "You know, if you're in the South and you say you're black, nobody's going to argue with you. And as you say, the gradient of colors in the South went from Walter White, who was whiter than basically anybody, whiter looking than Harry Truman, I guess. He was the head of the NAACP, and he considered himself a Negro. And that's the kind of, color was almost insignificant, except for the crazy people in the South who thought that if you had, you know, two drops of black blood, you had to sit in the back of the bus.
And so his series and his adventure, I guess, for lack of a better term, this was before Black Like Me, came out later in the 50s, but it was after the movie, or around the time of the movie Gentleman's Agreement, which talked about anti-Semitism. Talk about his traveling buddy, John Wesley Dobbs, and then, you know, just kind of give a very brief sketch of where they started from and where they ended up. And then let's talk about some of the specifics, because I think, and this is obviously part of what Spriggle was doing, that you, and again, your book is an incredibly painful and powerful recreation of, you know, of the time. And part of that was that Americans outside of the South didn't know or didn't care about the, you know, everyday indignities that were being heaped on blacks. And that was part of what he was trying to expose, right?
Absolutely. And Spriggle was not naive. He was a seasoned journalist as there ever was. And he was very smart. But he had no idea what was in store for him when he went into the South. And the NAACP eventually found him a guide named John Wesley Dobbs, D-O-B-B-S. And this guy, one of the superstars of history, and I'm afraid we've forgotten many of them, he was a prominent black man, social and political leader from Atlanta. He quoted Shakespeare plays at a drop of a hat. He had memorized 500 poems. He was a tremendous orator. He had made himself into a leader, and he would say that he was fighting for the black race all the time. He was considered a race man, is what they called him. And he wheeled and dealed in Atlanta and got black voters to sign up to register, and then he would trade those votes with the white city hall mayor and everybody, and so that they would get streetlights for the black sections or playgrounds for the black parts of town. So he was an unbelievable superstar. He was basically Spriggle's guide, host, and mentor and protector for 30 days. He drove Spriggle around, the two of them, in a 1947 Mercury with, you know, suicide doors and looked like a tank. And they went from Savannah to the Delta. They were based in Atlanta where Dobbs lived, and they would go on these sort of excursions over a month. And Dobbs passed Spriggle off as a light-skinned Negro from the South who worked for the NAACP as a field investigator. So Spriggle could interview everyone he talked to, and whether it was a sharecropper in a shack or whether it was a professor at Atlanta University. And Spriggle saw all those people. He saw the top middle-class layer of black society in the South. It was thin, but it existed. Every town had, you know, a black doctor, a black dentist, a black whatever. And Dobbs knew many of those people, and so he took Spriggle around to...
Well, and you talk about in the book when they would show up in towns throughout the South, and it's, you know, it's not like the North was any kind of, you know, utopia for blacks, but a lot of times there were either no hotels at all or certainly no hotels that would house blacks, so that there was a whole informal, you know, almost like Airbnb or home sharing economy.
You know, as we know, markets are pretty amazing at solving problems and creating things when either they're illegal or they're not provided by government. And in this case, because blacks had virtually nowhere to stay except in the big cities in hotels that were really rough. I mean, you wouldn't take your family to one of these hotels. The black middle class had created this network. As you say, it was like Airbnb, only all the black people in the South in the small towns would host fellow travelers, and they would not charge them for this, but they would. It was a reciprocal kind of arrangement, and it was all through the South. That's how black middle class people and businessmen, salesmen, and whatever. That's how they traveled. That's where they stayed, and so that's where Dobbs and Spriggle stayed at probably 15 or 20 of these homes throughout the South.
Talk about the way in which, you know, on their first train, the leg of, I guess they started out in Washington, D.C., and at the end of the first train leg, Spriggle and Dobbs get out and they go to hail a cab, and Spriggle has forgotten that he's now a black man in the South, and you know the South pretty much started in Washington, D.C. at the time, and he went out to hail a cab, and Dobbs was like, no, you know, what are you doing? And they have to go around to the back of the train station and wait for the Negro cab.
That was actually in Atlanta. They met in Washington at Union Station, which Washington, D.C. was not an official Jim Crow town, but it might as well have been. It was essentially a southern town. And that was thanks to starting with Wilson, but then thanks to all the southern segregationist senators and congressmen who basically ran D.C. in those days. Remember, it didn't have that autonomy that it has now. And they tried to set it up like a southern segregated town. So Washington was a bad town, but they hopped on a segregated train, a Jim Crow train from Union Station, and went overnight to Atlanta. And when they got to Atlanta, Spriggle, walking ahead of his friend Dobbs, who looked like the ambassador from Ethiopia, had about three bags, and he was a dude, this guy. Dobbs was a superstar. And Spriggle ran ahead to get the cab, and he went out the white exit, and he was approaching the white cabs when his friend Dobbs yelled at him and said, oh, come back, and he had to go out the black exit to where the Jim Crow black-colored cabs were, but there weren't any there, and they had to wait for a while. So that was Spriggle's immediate introduction to that whole society where, you know, Washington wasn't quite that bad, but Atlanta was, man, you didn't ride an elevator. You didn't, you know, everybody knows about the water fountains and everything, but they had a separate black Bible and a separate white Bible in courtrooms.
Tell the listeners about what it was like shopping for shoes and hats in the segregated South, because these are, you know, the small details which, you know, and it obviously, you know, the stories of lynchings and beatings and physical intimidation and assaults are horrifying, but it becomes unbearable when you telescope it down or microscope it down to these really petty interactions. But how did black people shop for shoes and hats in the South?
Well, you know, it was somebody called Jim Crow legalized humiliation, and that's pretty much what it was. Women, women would have to sit in the back of shoe stores, for instance, on a bench, and that's where they would try on the shoes. And if they went into department stores, they would have to, they would often put like a like Kleenex or a cloth on the black woman's head when she tried on a hat. And in other places, if you tried on something, you bought it. So you often had to buy the dress or the blouse or shirt or whatever without ever trying it on. And that was true in Pittsburgh. That was true as well into the 40s. The same thing. Blacks could not try on clothes in downtown Pittsburgh department stores.
Well, in the book you mentioned that New York City was generally considered the best city for black people in terms of, they had the most kind of room to live and to be and all of that. Why was New York different than other northern cities? And, what sparked that?
That's a good question. I would say that in part it was because of the numbers. I think there were somewhere around 700,000 or 800,000 black people in New York, which when you get that many numbers, things start happening and you're treated a little better. Of course they could vote. So they had political power to some degree that they didn't have at all in the Jim Crow South. And somebody like poor Tom Dewey, the big loser of 48, you look at now, he was as liberal as you could get. And New York State and the city of New York were the most liberal states in the Union in terms of race. Now, Pennsylvania and New York had equally strong laws against discrimination, but they weren't enforced in Pennsylvania. I mean, you had the big unions and big companies in Pittsburgh. I'm more familiar with Pittsburgh, obviously, because that's what I was focusing on. But, the unions, my favorite was the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and it had 14 members in Pittsburgh, or 1,400 members in Pittsburgh, and had one black. So that's the kind of segregation existed in Pittsburgh seriously in every way, in education and in jobs and in housing and any kind of opportunity. But New York was ahead of the curve on all of that, and Dewey was generally considered and loved by the black press for being ahead of the curve on integration.
And you mentioned Harry Truman, who won re-election in 1948, defeating Dewey. Truman came from Missouri, which was a Union state in the Civil War, but a slave state, and he himself was pretty racist for a while. But then he flipped because he did integrate the armed forces during the Korean War and did a couple of others. And all of these people have very mixed records on race. But what was driving Eleanor Roosevelt she's in the background of the book, but she's one of the heroes on race in American history. And, I think libertarians don't have a lot good to say about Eleanor Roosevelt, but she was right.
I grew up with my dad making fun of Eleanor Roosevelt for every reason. And, but he was a Republican and a conservative. And, I've basically come 180 degrees on Eleanor Roosevelt. She was truly a liberal and cared about black people and tried to get her husband and then Harry Truman. And Harry Truman was pissed sometimes. I guess in his diary, he would say, he'd basically say that, Eleanor was torturing me again over this stupid subject. But she really had Truman's ear. And Eleanor Roosevelt was also big buddies with Walter White, another superstar of my book. And there are a half a dozen of them. Walter White sort of lost the history, ran the NAACP from the early 30s till 1955, and he was they called him, he was a dynamo, a dynamo of a lobbyist for his race. He was busting the chops of the FDR people. He got close with Eleanor, and then he was busting Truman's chops, too. And he pretty much pushed Truman into making a speech in 1947, which was the first presidential announcement that the federal government was going to start leaning on states and you know, who were discriminating basically on race. I mean, it was all about the South, Jim Crow. He didn't even actually say the word Negro or black or anything in the speech, but everybody knew what he was talking about when he said that from now on the federal government was going to make sure that everyone had their rights regardless of their race.
Take us through one more anecdote about Spriggle and Dobbs in the South that you think is particularly illustrative of the experience and kind of the temperament of Ray Spriggle.
Well, Spriggle, again, he was no naive guy. He was no liberal crusader. He was a conservative Republican, a constitutionalist who in one of the few lengthy notes in his notebooks that I found, he was talking about the importance of property rights, and without property, you were just part of the swarm and stuff like that. So he was very much a constitutionalist, and when he saw what he saw, and he lived like a black man. He wasn't a reporter, a white guy tagging along with a black guy looking into the black world. He was pretending to be a black. He had to watch his step. He had to learn very quickly what blacks had to learn over a lifetime, and certainly in their childhood, that they could not speak first to a black to a white man. They could not call him anything but Mister. They would never use his first name. They had to sit in the back seat if a white person was driving a car. I mean, on and on and on.
You talk again to bring it down to these minute details on party lines, and most people in the 30s, certainly, and even into the 40s, had party lines for phones. And if you were a black person, you wouldn't be called Mister or Mrs.
Right.
I mean, it really is a. I
the
mean,
operators would refuse to say that Mrs. Jackson is on the line. They would demand her first name.
It's a systematic and ritualized humiliation of. So give an example. One choice anecdote where Spriggle loses his shit or is just like is totally floored by what he's experiencing.
Well, and I'm trying to think of a specific thing. It happened over a month, but he very quickly felt like he was a second-class citizen, and he understood that. And I'm trying to think of if there was a specific event. I mean, part of the thing was that he watched his step very carefully. He was 61 years old. He was not interested in getting hit over the head or thrown in jail for protesting Jim Crow customs, you know. So he was as servile and as sheepish as any 61-year-old black man might want to be when he was in public. And I'm trying to think, there wasn't any major events. We're going to have to leave it to Hollywood to come up with some dramatic event. I mean, you know, Spriggle and Dobbs slept in the same double bed on a prosperous farm in Northwest Georgia the night of a picnic that there was having up there, where Spriggle found himself to be the only white man at this picnic of about 150 people south of Chattanooga, but it was actually in Georgia. And they asked Spriggle to stand up at one point. The host, the man who owned the farm, that asked Mr. Spriggle to stand up, and his name was Crawford. That was the name he was going by. And they said, Mr. Crawford, tell us what the state of the Negro is in Pittsburgh, where you're from. And Spriggle stood up, and he said he was willing to carry out a lot of deception, but he wasn't going to go that far. And he just begged off and said, I'm not, he told the truth. He said, I'm not in a position to really say that. And he sat down. And he was nervous about that. You know, he wasn't really found out by anybody of any importance to be a white man. One or two people suspected him, but it was no big deal. You know, they traveled 3,000 miles by car. They pissed in the bushes together. They slept in a double bed together. They ate in crummy at the back door of a couple of places. They did not get into any trouble with the law or white people or the sheriffs or anything. There wasn't any major thing. That's, you know, what's interesting about it is that he was able to move around for 30 days as a black person and observe from the inside without getting his head busted. But he was passionate about what he saw. And when he wrote his series, he came back from his trip and he wrote a 21-part series for the Post-Gazette, and that was syndicated in other papers around the country. And he let it rip. It was like a page one op-ed piece. And
what was what was the impact? What was the reaction to Spriggle's 21-part series?
Well, it was pretty amazing. He had the whole country talking about the subject of segregation, legal segregation. From coast to coast, literally. Newspapers were the big media of the day, and newspapers, news magazines, and network radio. But every paper, every town had a daily paper. And even a small town, pick a small town in Ohio, you know, Springfield, Ohio, or, you know, they had a newspaper. And if you wanted to find out what was going on in the Arab-Israeli war, which had just broken out during their trip, you read your daily, you know, Connellsville, PA paper. And they would have the maps and, you know, all the latest dispatches from Tel Aviv and all that stuff. And newspapers were extremely powerful. Every family had one, basically about 1.3 newspapers per household, apparently. So his series was a newspaper series. It was page one in about 15 papers, major papers, New York Herald Tribune to Seattle Times. And it got everybody talking. The South got all pissed off. They never printed a word of Spriggle's series. Not one paper in the South carried it. It was all carried in the South. And they wrote editorials decrying it and praising it, depending on whether you're in the North or South. Columnists in the North and South wrote about it. Eleanor Roosevelt went gaga over it. Walter White was talking to all the publishers in New York, and Spriggle very quickly got a book deal, and that came out in the spring of 49, called In the Land of Jim Crow. And then there was, at the time, there was a show, a radio program called Town Meeting of the Air, which nobody remembers. It must have been in its 25th or 30th year by this time, in 1948. And it was heard by as many as 10 million people every Tuesday night. And Spriggle, Walter White, Hodding Carter, who was the liberal voice of the South, he treated blacks well, and he treated them well in his newspaper in Greenville, Mississippi, but he was a diehard segregationist. And then Harry Ashmore, who would win a Pulitzer for covering the Central Little Rock Central High School integration scene in the 1950s. The four of them had this hour-long debate, and several million people heard it. 2,500 letters were sent in to the program. There were, I would say, you know, hundreds of editorials, scores and scores of editorials, hundreds of letters to the editor, hundreds of letters, thousands of letters to the radio station. For about 4 months, segregation, what should we do about legal segregation, was debated in the national media and in the local media, which was your daily paper, from coast to coast. And it came and went, and it was all a result of one man, Ray Spriggle. You know, it shows you the power of a single journalist.
And it certainly fed into, I mean, you were talking earlier about how after World War II, where blacks had an expanded role in the armed forces and they came back, you know, certainly soldiers, veterans, you know, and they were pissed, you know, even more pissed because you fight for your country and then you're told to eat standing up in the back of the restaurant if you're allowed in at all. But Spriggle's work obviously built into that movement, which I guess peaked first in with the integration of the armed forces during the Korean War and then Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. So it it was part of a moment of not just consciousness being raised on the part of blacks and calls for equality, but also on the parts of whites.
Yes, and it was, it came and went, unfortunately, because this again was 1948, so it was, 6 years before Brown versus Board of Education, about 7 or 8 years before Emmett Till was murdered. That was really the event that caught the attention of the white North. Prior to what Spriggle did, the white North read white papers, and the black folks of America read black papers, and they never read each other. Well, the blacks had to read white papers, but white people never read black papers. And papers like the Pittsburgh Courier, the largest at the time, wrote constantly for decades about how awful Jim Crow was, how blacks were persecuted and prosecuted, you know, political and social and economic problems of the South and lynchings and the trials of lynchings. They were over the top advocates for the black people, and, you know, all rules of journalism were thrown away by these black papers. But white people never read them, so they didn't know what was going on. And white papers didn't cover blacks in the South, in Africa, or in their own backyards in Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh papers, three dailies in 1948, hardly ever wrote a word about the 120,000 blacks living in their area.
So the book is 30 Days of Black Man, the forgotten story that exposed the Jim Crow South. The author is Bill Steigerwald. Bill, your previous book was about another famous American who took a road trip, John Steinbeck. And you tried to you retrace the steps that he laid out, or the route that he claimed to have taken in Travels with Charlie. Give us a quick capsule summary of what you found. And obviously there's a pattern here. You like, you know, guys who go out and, you know, spend a lot of time in a car driving around the country. But it turned out you caused a stir yourself when you retraced Travels with Charlie. And what did you immediately find out about Steinbeck's veracity?
Well, I like to say that I found out that Steinbeck was basically a lying bastard. When he did his what was supposed to be a nonfiction account, the true account of his trip for his book, Travels with Charlie, which he made in the fall of 1960. And he was on the road 75 days, and he drove from Long Island to the top of Maine, out through Chicago, Seattle, Monterey, California, Texas, New Orleans, and back. And everybody loves it. Kids love it. Older people love it because they read it as kids. But I wanted to follow his trail exactly as a journalist 50 years later, which I did do. And my idea at the time was just to compare 2010 America with 1960 America and the changes and everything. And in the course of doing the research, I very quickly found out that Steinbeck had made up quite a bit of his book, including most of the characters he said he met. And I basically proved, to the satisfaction of the publisher who changed the introduction to the book on for its 50th anniversary, and said, "Hey, this isn't quite a true account. It's more fiction than nonfiction."
You even got the New York Times to rail against Steinbeck 50 years after.
One of my great things, as a libertarian and as someone who has spent his life criticizing the liberal bias of the New York Times, to read an editorial, in-house editorial. I mean, we newspaper guys know how important they are. And it's, you know, it said Bill Steigerwald has discovered an intriguing fact or something. That's the way it started out. I'm thinking, all right. But basically, what I showed was that Steinbeck's book, Travels with Charlie, which was the only book he ever had that made number one on the New York Times bestseller list, by the way, and it's nonfiction. That it was a myth that he traveled rough, that he traveled alone, that he traveled slow to discover America, and that he liked America because he didn't like America at all, but he didn't put that in the book. He traveled with his wife more than half the time. He drove as fast as he could from city to city. I may have overdone it, but I think I pretty thoroughly showed that he was a lying bastard. But also, his publisher did a lot of it, too. Steinbeck wrote the original draft, which I looked at, handwritten, and then you can see the edits, and the marketing people and the editors at Viking Press were very, very sly in their way they edited the original draft to make it appear that Steinbeck.
Well, it's also it is a kind of fascinating companion to 30 Days of Black Man, because both of these accounts, the power of them. You know, the power of Travels with Charlie, if it was a novel, it wouldn't have mattered in the same way. That the idea that it was a true eyewitness account of 1960s America mattered. Ray Spriggle, it's, you know, that he was telling the truth and that he was giving details on a world that was real, you know, very important. So it's I find both of these books, you know, just tremendous reads. You know, the first one was a Dogging Steinbeck is a great work of, you know, kind of journalistic and literary detective work. And it was interesting that biographers of Steinbeck didn't really want to engage you because it complicates all sorts of shit. And we've seen that in other memoirs where people say certain things that either didn't happen or they kind of compile and collate many different people into one character who is not quite real. You know, that's always an ongoing thing. But then, you know, 30 Days of Black Man, this book, Bill, I can't praise it enough. It is, you know, it is so harrowing. It's got a great introduction by Juan Williams, who, you know, kind of helps set the stage. And throughout the book, the way that you go from the larger context of where America was and how blacks were treated, and then to Spriggle's, you know, particular experiences and the way that he came to understand a world that he had kind of had been transparent or invisible to him. What do you think is, you know, what's the takeaway of 30 Days of Black Man, of Ray Spriggle's living in the Jim Crow South in 21st century America? What do you hope readers take away from this?
Well, I hope that they take away what I took away after doing the research. I thought I knew enough, you know, when I started the book. By the time I was done, by the time I read about what they had written into the housing codes in Baltimore and Washington and Seattle that said no house shall be sold to a non-Caucasian, by the time I saw the depth and the width and the horrible, you know, humiliations imposed upon 10 million American citizens, these were, you know, these weren't immigrants. These were American citizens whose constitutional rights had been deprived. You know, they never really got their full ones, and you know, they were treated like second class, third class citizens. So what I would take away from it is that when you see, as you nicely described, the scope of what America was like in 1948, North and South, mainly South, because it was legalized segregation. Legal. It was apartheid. You know, we basically had apartheid before South Africa did. And when you see what black people had to put up with, and you see the extent of it, and you think, man, I didn't know that going into this. Spriggle didn't know it when he went on his trip. I certainly didn't know it when I started this book. But I have such a deeper appreciation for the punishment that black people received from their government for so long, and the crass politics that perpetuated it, and the blindness of the North and the white people, the best people of the North, good white people of the North, had no idea what was going on in the South, had no idea that people were living like it was 1880 in the Mississippi Delta, you know. None of this was known to the people in 1948. And here I am, I'm 70 years old almost, and I'm supposed to be an educated guy and, you know, a man of the world, and a newspaper guy, yada, yada, yada. And I didn't know 90% of this stuff. And I think that most white people and many, many black people don't know how bad it was, what a nasty country this was. And it was nasty. People can be nasty to each other, as we know. But I can contend, based on my trip around the country several times in cars, that most people are good people and nice people and treat people with respect and dignity and all that good stuff. But when you are able to impose a a regulatory system on a whole set of people the way Jim Crow was. And there was all this extra legal and subtle, I guess, quote unquote, subtle stuff with the housing policies and things that perpetuated segregation in the North. When you see all that, you think, man, black people, we're lucky black people didn't have a lot of guns.
Yep.
They had every right to revolt.
Well, you know, the other thing I think that comes through loud and clear in the book, too, are that you talked about the half dozen superstars, but whether it's Ray Spriggill or John Wesley Dobbs or Walter White or Eleanor Roosevelt, or John Dewey, the individuals who really stepped up and made a difference, it's also inspiring. I mean, it shouldn't have to happen, and it all took too long. But there's also that.
Somebody like Walter White, who's been very much forgotten, you know, he's had a couple books written about him. He wrote some books. He's a good writer and all this stuff. You know, if he's not, he should be a movie. I mean, there should be a mega movie about this guy. He was a total superstar. And there's all kinds of drama because he was so white and the white-black thing. And, I mean, you know, it gets complicated.
Well, the courage or maybe the stupidity almost of, like, having a choice in 1930s America where you could identify as white or black and choosing black. That's a goddamn incredible statement.
Absolutely. And also, you know, when you ask what I learned, I've sort of come up with a three-part slogan, and that is what I learned in doing this book, and I think you often learn this about when anybody goes back in history, that nothing is new, everything was worse, and what you thought was simple or true was not. And when you look back at 48 and you see the stuff, and Ray Spriggill's reporting, you know, he was a reporter. When he heard guys in Atlanta say, oh, Atlanta's a great city for black people, nothing ever happens here. Well, he went down to the courthouse and dug up the records, and he came up with three cases in the last 2 years where young black males, this sounds a little familiar, were shot dead by cops or trolley conductors who were armed at the time and were able to shoot anybody, and they were shot dead, and the defense was always, oh, I thought he was reaching for his gun or a gun or something, I shot him dead, and they all got off. I mean, you could take those examples and put them in the paper today, and people would say, well, yeah.
Well, we will leave it there. Bill, thank you. Bill Steigerwald, a retired newspaper man who you've been writing more since you've retired, I suspect, or at least as much. The latest book is 30 Days of Black Man, The Forgotten Story That Exposed the Jim Crow South. It's out. You can pick it up at Amazon and Barnes & Noble in all sorts of formats. It tells the tale of Ray Spriggill, a famous journalist from Pittsburgh, a white man who traveled the South as a black man for a month in 1948. Bill, thanks so much. Is there a next project on the drawing board already?
No, I don't know. I'm just getting a movie made so I can get paid for all my hard work. No, I mean, I love doing this story, and it was my responsibility to do it about Spriggill. I knew that if I didn't do it, no one ever would, because I know his daughter, who's still alive, a wonderful person, and I had accumulated information and gone on trips in the South to retrace parts of his original journey. I did that in 98 and in 2009. So it was either me or nobody. And right now I'm just sort of like, I'm an Uber driver. I'm a happy Uber driver. Maybe I'll write a mystery novel about an Uber driver.
Well, that's, we'll have a different podcast about your experiences as an Uber driver and as a part of the sharing and gig economy, because I know that you're a big supporter of that and at a time where the tide seems to be turning, but we'll leave that conversation for another time. Thanks again. We've been talking with Bill Steigerwald, the author of 30 Days of Black Man, The Forgotten Story That Exposed the Jim Crow South. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick.
And this has been The Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. You'll never miss an episode. You can rate and review us while you're there. It helps us know what we're doing right, what we need to work on, and it helps us get more viewers at iTunes. So please go to iTunes and subscribe to The Reason Podcast. Thanks again.